Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is called practical politics because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is, of course, rule-based politics, which is what you do at the voting booth. It's very, very rule-based and timeline-based, you know, every 4 years, every 2 years, so on and so forth. And full-spectrum practical politics is engaging and taking out an opponent or a system or a corporation, so on and so forth, by any means necessary under the rules or under the laws, but never breaking the rules or never breaking the laws. But to understand anything, we first have to teach you practical politics, which is non-voting politics. The first basics are the art of staying on point or using a talking point and being able to say it over and over again to make your point, not arguing, just making a point. But this is an introduction, again, to Follow the White Rabbit, and Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. This MP3 is going to be a war special. I'm going to go over all kinds of interesting news. We're going to go back over topics. I'm going to show you how it relates to what's going on in the current, what's happening right now with Russia, what's happening with Germany as we prepare for the Green Goddess going wild. Yeah, she's going to go wild across this planet. We're getting ready for World War III. The prospects are very high between right now. As I'm talking here, this is, like around April 5th or April 18th or somewhere in that area, April 18th to April 20th, I'll be talking, doing this MP3, and we're going to go over news events. But between right now and early summer is high time for war. And I'll go into the reasons for that, because everything's falling to pieces and it's starting to rapidly decay. I've talked about this before, that I was always told that late 2007, 2008, if you don't have your New World Order, it ain't going to happen, because everything on the planet is going to start going to pieces. And that's what's happened right in front of my face, so I tend to believe it. From 2008 to 2012, everything's gone to pieces. We had a big stock market rally in 2009. This weekend they're talking about passing this big health care bill. I don't even know what's all in it, but I'm sure it's not all that wonderful, other than it'll bankrupt America, which is already bankrupt. In other words, it'll be a what you see is what you get bankruptcy. We've been a wide sky bankruptcy all my life, but this is going to be what you see is what you get bankruptcy. In other words, most of my life, America's been at the prospect of you're going to have to make radical changes because China's trying to make itself non-Chinese. In 1965, America was 90% European, 90% white rabbit. China right now is 91% Chinese rabbits. If China tried to make itself non-Chinese, you're going to eventually go bankrupt, or you're going to have problems there. You're going to have to reconcile that. So all my lifetime, no one's ever reconciled this, and now it's crunch time, and you got a mulatto prince passing a crazy healthcare bill that I don't know, maybe elements of it are wonderful. It's so far gone it doesn't matter. But what's happened is people are starting to realize that this is so far gone it doesn't matter. That it's gone. That their 401ks and everything else. But as this passes, I would expect the stock market to just get start its next leg down that you saw in 2008. That's what I would expect. And these are all movements coming into the big war. And Obama's finishing putting the nails on the coffin of what was once America. And it's gotten to the point now that most white Americans don't even want, they want the country maybe they grew up in the 50s or whatever, but they know that there's going to have to be radical changes. Once white rabbits come into that mindset, that's not a bad thing, that's a good thing. It just takes them a long time to get there. Yeah, once they visually see Obama, once they start realizing everything, once they see it over and over again, there's no harm there. It just takes a while to get them to that point. John McCain would be doing the same things and they'd be frustrated, but nothing would be racial. This is wonderful because everything becomes racial overnight. There's been more radicalization of white America since 2008 than any time in the history of, probably in the history of the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. They are radical. They are being radicalized. John McCain wouldn't be doing anything differently. You know, he wanted to put Al Gore up there to handle the environmental policy, and he would have been green to all kinds of things to kill us. You know, John McCain was pro-white genocide. But he's white, so he gets away with it. Tali Obama's pro-white genocide, but he's a mulatto prince. He can't do anything. He can't do anything without making it racial. Healthcare, that's racial. That's fine. It's been racial my whole entire life. Let's get honest. But, you know, the idea that he's bankrupting America, well, he's putting, he's basically sticking the knife in further. And, you know, there's already a knife there. He's sticking it in further. He's getting it to the point where it could be remade, which is okay. You know, you've got to get things worse before you can get things better, that type of thing. But this MP3 is going to be a war special. A war special. As we go into war, you know, you're going to see we're seeing all kinds of different machinations. We're seeing different big political movements in America, further radicalizing, true Americans. That means, well, you know, the indigenous white rabbits of Europe that came and developed America. Those are the true Americans. Everyone else is a U.S. citizen, just visiting. And U.S. citizenship is just a visiting pass. Yeah, it's just a visiting pass. That's all you have. And as we come into this war, everything's being radicalized. The world is actually being radicalized against America, and white America's being radicalized against America. So it's kind of funny. You know, this old man at the grocery store was like, was reading the headlines of the Chinese, and I'm going to go over this. The Chinese have turned against us. When Obama first became president, he went over there and wanted a partnership. You know, some of his neocon masters. Some of his masters are neocons, are all around him, or Jew rabbits. Jew rabbits are all around Obama, visually. If you look around Obama visually, you're going to see nothing but Jew rabbits. And that's good. But they wanted him to go to some of the pink rabbit banksters and Leadsters sent him over there to do this deal with China. He was supposed to get this special agreement to have a special partnership with China. And China said, we don't want a partnership. We're just a developing country. China backed out on him at the last minute. And that's when it started hurting. That's when it started stinging. Yeah, China's not what you think. But anyways, this old man at the grocery store was reading his headlines that China was talking tough. I mean, they're going at it financially. China, Google's taking down its Chinese search engines. We've talked about this. China's backed out of their New World Order plan because there ain't going to be a New World Order the way you think, little Jew rabbit. No, no, no. Your masters are in trouble. But I've already talked about what type of trouble they're in. And as what he was reading is that, you know, all these problems with China, you know, and I'm going to read the actual news headlines in a bit, but the Chinese, there's a lot of verbal rhetoric. The whole entire world is a lot of rhetoric against America, against all these crazy rabbits at the top of Anglosphere, specifically America. And most of them, the whole entire front is Jewish with the mulatto prince. And of course, Hillary's sitting in the background, yeah, but Hillary doesn't get a lot of attention. Not as much as she probably should, but that's okay. And he's reading these headlines. These headlines talk about Chinese anger at this or that at the United States. And he was saying, you know, China seems like they're as mad as America's as Americans like me. You know, basically what he was saying, he went on this long tangent about, you know, the whole world's upset at America, but so am I. Yeah, you know, this old white guy, he was just ticked off. But he'd never been ticked off his whole entire life, but now he's ticked off. You know, old World War II generation guy. It's kind of funny. So the whole entire world's mad at America, and white America's mad at America. So it should be interesting. We got a small group that has got themselves in some trouble. And I'm going to go over something briefly. I was asked a question, or I was asked to actually talk a little deeper about something. One of my legal eagles, I'll call this one element of my group, the legal eagles, had talked about. I read the laws for genocide and ethnic cleansing, and I'm going to go over that again because our message. If you go to the front page of whiterabbitradio.net, you're going to see white rabbit genocide, and that's a mantra as applied to white rabbits, and that's a consistent message. That's the message you're to be on. You're going to see talking points that go toward genocide. You're going to see the famous, in all caps, the mantra. That's your mantra. That's my mantra. That's our consistent message. And those of you that are on it, you're on it night and day, and you're doing a phenomenal job. Yeah, it's all over the place all of a sudden, which is what we want. And this, it's not all of a sudden. It's been building. It's been building for the last few years. Coming into when I started this in May, last May, almost a year ago. Not quite a year ago. I started planning it about a year ago this time. We're 15 years out of demoralization, as my listeners know. We had to be on a consistent message. We've been on one. Coming into last fall, it really started coming out there. By last September, last August, last September, it was starting to scare people. Because you gotta watch it. This stuff can just wind up and all of a sudden be on top of you and just basically, annihilate you. Sound is like that. Sound is extremely violent. But in doing this, I've told you about the laws of ethnic cleansing and the Article 2 of the Convention of Prevention, Punishment of Crime of Genocide from 1948. And I'm going to go over ethnic cleansing and, again, genocide, and I'm going to explain some things to you that the Legal Eagles made me aware of that that may have been unclear. None of it bad, but all of it very good. And I want to go into some different go into a brief explanation. But that consistent message is an indictment. We're charging someone with genocide. Then we're not charging African rabbits. We're not charging Mexican rabbits. They don't have any power. We're charging rabbits that look like us that have no power with us. It would be some elements of the Jewish elites. That's kind of what you see is what you get. Some of the think tanks, the social engineering schools, the pink rabbit banksters and elitesters, they know who they are. But that's our job. Our job is to get on a consistent message and charge them with the attempted genocide, the largest ever. It has teeth. It is ruthless. It is their most vulnerable point. The key was to get a consistent message and to be able to use it with demoralization coming off. You know, the whole society is waking up. The media control is just negligible. Our enemy has very little media control because everything's online. But let's go over ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing is rendering an area ethnically homogenous by using force or intimidation to remove from a given area persons of another group or religious group. Most people assume ethnic cleansing is killing. It is not under international law. It will not be. It has nothing to necessarily do with killing. And we're going to go over genocide again. The Convention on the Prevention of Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in 1948 defines genocide Article 2 as any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, religious, or racial religious group. And I'm going to read this to you, but this is off the UN.org Prevent Genocide website. You can go to UN.org, that's UnitedNations.org, but it's just UN.org Prevent Genocide, Prevent Genocide. If you Google UN Prevent Genocide, you'll hear all kinds of stuff about that. You can read it all. But basically, it says, what is genocide, and then it goes on to talk about it, and I've explained this to you before, but I'm going to go a little bit deeper. Killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. That's a big one. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. Forcibly transferring children of one group of the group to another group. Now, once you go over that, you realize that something here has been clearly and consistently targeting. The American Indians. The American Indians have looked over the social engineering, but no one can really figure out what they were trying to do with it. Everyone assumes they're targeting them, but they're not targeting Indians. They did annihilate the Indians. In fact, the Indians are probably the indigenous red rabbits of North America are extremely damaged party by this stuff. I remember when the Russians were out looking at the Lakota Republic. They've looked all over it at the all the different. But what the Indians have not realized, maybe a couple do now. If they've heard this, is that they're not being targeted. They're a damaged party, but you're not necessarily targeting them. Ethnically cleansed? Absolutely. But it doesn't really matter who was ethnically cleansed in the 15th century or 17th century. It has to be post-1948. But you have to know what they're targeting. Because once you target a group for extinction, you got to get it done. That's a dangerous area to go into under international law. It's actually dangerous, period. Because sooner or later, they're going to find out about it. No time in the history of the world has someone attempted to target their founding gene pool and destroy it. It's just, it's so unnatural, most people don't know what they're looking at. But someone is on record thousands of times saying they're going to wipe out white rabbits through force blending and all this other perverted stuff. And of course, you have a lot of damaged parties because of it. But one charge of genocide with an actual ethnic cleansing, you know, if you say you're going to wipe someone out and it doesn't work, but yeah, you end up ethnically cleansing or hurting someone else, you're in trouble. You know, you can't design social engineering pool. You can't in any way, shape, manner, or form deliberately inflict conditions on a group to calculate to bring about its physical destruction, whole or in part. You just can't go there. Most people aren't stupid enough to go on record. Your enemy is. They're extremely arrogant. Extremely arrogant. But even on the UN website, it will talk about this, and this is what's important to understand. All such acts are violations of human rights and may also be crimes against humanity or war crimes, depending on the context in which they were committed. And I'll comment on this. Well, you're not dealing with war crimes, obviously, because we're not in a conventional war. It's asymmetrically attacking someone. So it would definitely be crimes against humanity and violation of human rights, clearly. The convention, and I'll read again, convention confirms that genocide, whether committed in time of peace or war, is a crime under international law which parties to the convention undertake to prevent and to punish, Article 1. And that's quotes. Because it is part of international customary law, the convention is considered applicable in all countries irrespective of whether they have signed it or ratified it. It doesn't matter if you've signed it or ratified it. It's applicable to you, period. Therein lies the challenge with this stuff. I talked before, and one of my legal eagles said, I talked before that America was a very big and powerful country. And Henry Kissinger never really was afraid of war crime trials or anything like that because he had a lot of groups protecting him. And that, you know, when you're big and powerful, that can work. But when you start going bankrupt, you got problems in that area. That's the point I was making. But hopefully I made it very clear. But don't think that just because someone hasn't signed or ratified it, because you get into this thing that we're not talking about the U.S. military trying to genocide European children. We're not talking about anything conventional. We're not talking about any conventional war crimes. Most genocide trials and ethnic cleansing trials happen under war crimes. Well, but it doesn't need to be so. It can be a crime against humanity or human rights violations. It can be any combination. It's ruthless stuff because it is applicable in all countries irrespective of whether they have signed it or ratified it. Doesn't matter if Saddam Hussein didn't sign on to it. Once they get you down, it's applicable, period. It's ruthless stuff, and that's one of the reasons you're on a consistent message, because it is that ruthless. It is the most violent thing available. And that's what you want. You want the right time, the right place, the right time, and hit them with the most violent weapon you have. That is sound. That sound goes toward genocide. And these laws are nothing to fool with. If the Russians got someone down, they're going to hang you. And they won't stop. I'm going to go, when I go into this, and I'm going to go on many different tangents on this one. So those of you that hate when I go on to tangents, this may not be for you. Because I'm going to go over news events. I'm going to talk about what Russia's doing. But they have threatened everything. Coming into last fall, we were threatening everything from every different angle. Because that's how you attack. You don't attack from one direction. You attack from everything available, from every weapon available in any way, shape, manner, or form. And of course, over there at Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar, they've been on the genocide. You know, we've been on the genocide. I've been reading about them in genocide since the late 90s. Everyone has seen what they were going with this. We were going with this. A consistent message came out. It has to be the perfect time for the thing to take hold. But it is ruthless stuff. There's a great deal of fear in this. The average white nationalist might read this and say, how does this apply to us? The UN doesn't have any power to do anything for you. Black rabbits don't have any power to do anything for you. They can be very noisy. You know, if they think they're entitled to something because there was an attempt to genocide against white rabbits, it gets them all angst ridden. You know, but they can be noisy, and that can count. You know, there's a lot of the Muslims are probably the biggest group of national socialists the world has ever seen. They can't do anything for Germans, but man, can they be noisy. There's another large group I'm gonna go into that in this. I'm gonna talk about news and about national socialism and its growth in South America. It's going to be another tangent I go on, but this stuff is just ruthless. It is violent, and sound is violent. Yes, I mean you're basically, they know exactly what you're saying when you do the mantra. They know exactly what you're saying when you charge genocide. The average anti-racist might not understand it. It doesn't matter. They don't have any power. We are putting pressure. Pressure from below, pressure from above. To get pressure going from above, you really have to apply it from below. We're not interested in scaring those without power. We want to scare those with power. You do that with a consistent message, and you do that with charging them with something like this. Why would certain elements be interested in charging? Because you can hang tens of thousands of them. No questions asked. Yeah, there's no walking away from a tribunal. Some people thought that Saddam Hussein might get off. It doesn't work that way. You've never seen anyone in your lifetime get out of a tribunal. You may go to jail forever, or you may get hanged, or you may go to jail and get poisoned or something, but you're not walking away from a tribunal. There's no voting there. Remember, this is all no voting politics. So those of you on a consistent message, so there's quite a number, a growing number across Western civilization. You're doing a phenomenal job. And even into last fall, we had broad-based panic because this is ruthless stuff to anyone that knows about it. And your enemy knows all about it. That's their most vulnerable point. That's their most vulnerable point. They're extremely unnatural, and they do unnatural things, like trying to replace their founding gene pool. And that's where we're going with this. We're just consistently putting pressure around this. But don't think, because someone hasn't signed it or ratified it, that it doesn't apply to them. No, it does. It says so right on the website. Everyone knows that. I didn't want to come across that, well, America didn't sign it, therefore it wouldn't be applicable to elements within America. Well, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way at all. It means if you're big and powerful, if Saddam Hussein is big and powerful and holding up an enemy, well, it's not applicable to him until someone takes him down to size. And there's always something bigger in nature to take you down to size. It matters until the morning you go broke. The morning you go broke, those laws will come into play big time. You know, Bernie Madoff could get around the laws for years and years and years. But one morning, on one day, Bernie Madoff, the whole house of cards came in on him. When you break the law, it can happen like that, especially when you break these kind of laws, especially when you have the type of groups that would like to crucify them. Yeah, there are some groups in this world that are not white, that know what we have on them, that want to crucify them. Some of the Chinese, because they destroyed China at one time. They sponsored communism in China. There's more than one side of the Chinese equation. And they don't care how you get them, just get them. They're not picky. You know, all these white rabbits want to run around shooting at everybody. You know, they're all bent out of shape. And I'm talking about your average mom, pop, conservative and liberal is getting bent out of shape. They're more radical than the steely-eyed lone wolfers now. They are. You got old, old terrible Tommy who's actually putting his name on the ballot or running on a ballot in Illinois for something or other. I think Congress or something. Allowing radicals to vote for him. That's good. But he's going to probably find out that people walking up and down the street, if he doesn't know it already, are more radical than him already. They passed him by. They're radical. There's some groups on this planet that want, but bullets, you know, bullets, rope can do the same thing as bullets, and the law can be just as violent as any law in the wild. The law in international and under international law, the law can be more violent than anything in the wild, wild west, and it's more humiliating. So that's why there's a great deal of fear in this, and there will continue. There will always continue to be a great deal of fear until there's a free for all and international law comes down. But in my opinion, that's one of the reasons they're going to war. They're going to war because they don't have a way out of it, or at least this group doesn't. Now, your average Jew rabbit doesn't understand that. They think they're going to win something. No. Your average liberal, your average conservative rabbit, they don't understand anything going on this planet, in my opinion. But they're going to war because they're in so much trouble they don't have a way out. They've had to negotiate this, to negotiate that, and pretty soon there's nothing left to negotiate. Every negotiation leads to new negotiations, so this should be fascinating. But in this MP3, I'm going to go on various different tangents. I'm going to go over stuff I've talked about before, and we're going to talk about all the current news, because I've missed some. I have put off going over some current news reports, and there's a lot going on, and I'm going to go back over it. It may go a little bit longer, but we'll call this the War News Special, and I may go on some tangents. So if you don't like it when I go on tangents, I'm sorry. This isn't some million dollar broadcast that I write out. Now, granted, I could probably write things out, and I could probably appease those rabbits that want me to do a more professional production, but it is what it is, and it's free. So take it while it's hot, or get it while it's hot. But I'll be back, and we'll start going over all the crazy news reports coming out. In the first part, I did a Freudian slip. I said that I was talking to you on April 18th or something like that. Well, I'm not a time traveler, so it's not April 18th. It's like March 18th at March 20th. I was doing a Freudian slip because I expect war to take place sometime like after Easter, between Easter and July, and if not, then in the fall. But I have a feeling it may be sooner simply because of the different movements around the world. And, groups getting ready, and it's become pretty obvious that something big's cooking. But right now there's a lot of financial problems. Those financial problems are being escalated. They're being escalated by China. There's talk of a new protectionist bill in China. You've got Germany backtracking on European rescue for Greece. Well, Germany, lower Europe, is going to have to do its own thing if you're outside of Italy. They're doing all kinds of different things to shake up the financial situation, and that will affect, the current ruler of the world, which is, America and the U.S. dollar, at least in the short to intermediate term. You know, we've had a huge stock market rally in 2009. The whole entire world's collapsing. In America, I mean, everything is horrible except the stock market. I mean, we're getting our carrots on time. We're getting our carrot pizzas on time and everything, but most of the world is in tough shape. Mexico is in outright civil war. Mexico is a virtual bloodbath. Those Mexican rabbits are whacking each other night and day. Now they say, oh, it's just confined to the drug czars and whatnot. I don't know about that. You know, they're cutting off heads, and it's been escalating all around the world. This, you know, it's a time for change, as they say. But seeing what goes on with it, there could be any catalyst to set up anything to upset markets. And anything that upsets markets, upsets 401ks, upsets retirements, is going to upset mom and pop America, which is white America. And white America is already upset. So how can you get them more upset? Well, someone could upset an apple cart. Germany pulling the rug out from underneath Greece in the short term. The rhetoric between China, they're talking about passing a bill and screwing over the yuan or something like that. Anything to upset the current financial stability, because they've done a great job at levitating after the housing collapse. But, you know, magicians can't really perform magic. If the world's in a financial crisis, that's eventually going to come out into financial assets. If the world's in a total crisis, it's eventually going to be priced in the stock market. Now, how or when am I calling a crash? I don't know, but I would look for things to start going bad all at once right before the war. It just wouldn't surprise me, this type of thing to go. But it's been a long time coming. I think a lot of people are starting to realize that. Even many mom-and-pop Americans are starting to realize that things are a lot worse than they're saying, and there's going to have to be radical changes. There's nothing bad with coming to that certainty. Getting them to come to that conclusion can take a great deal of time. But, you know, you have Front Page Mag and the China Dream, and they talk about China, and China has backed out of the neocon New World Order. China had backed out at the last minute, said that they're just a developing country, which is fascinating stuff. And it talks about, from its aggressive trade policy to its military buildup, and from the bloc politics at the UN to its support of rogue regimes around the world, Beijing's rise is generating confrontations with American interests that can no longer be ignored. This is neocons. Now, neocons are generally putting out Chinese love specials. You know, the Chinese are brilliant. They love the Chinese. Basically, these guys are going to go to war against everybody. And we've been pulled into our military, unfortunately for them, has been pulled into a pincer move. You know, they've been enveloped over there in the Middle East, and you got Israel there ready to do what the Jew rabbits do, and that's dance in the fire with the ring. You know, we're at the end of the Lord of the Rings, and the Dark Age is ending, and this one's going to go out with a bang. But the Chinese have to have a clean break. They cannot survive, and they got all kinds of problems. And they're not interested in a new world order. They're not interested in what that entails. At least elements of China are not, and that's what counts. they're not interested in the type of confrontation, but that most people think they are. But if you have China, Russia, German soft power, and we're vulnerable, I would not want to be a soldier in the Middle East or anywhere in the world for America. I feel bad for them. There was a couple young soldiers, younger than me, that is, that were talking about re-enlisting, and they asked me my view, and I told them exactly what I thought would happen and how big the war would be, and they didn't re-enlist. Now, you might say that's bad or that's whatever. If they weren't, you know, if they were running around on Homeland Defense or something, I told them to get involved in something like that or get involved with something at home. There's all kinds of things that they could do at home to serve their country, be a police officer or something. You know, if you've been over there in Iraq at all or Afghanistan, you could be a police officer. You can be Homeland Defense. You could do anything. But, you know, if you're there, you're going to be in the middle of the biggest war the world's ever seen. And even if you're in Japan or something like that, I don't know. The wise men, I used to say, how big is this war going to be with Iran when it goes? And this was quite a long time ago. I didn't think this was going to happen. And now the whole world sees it's going to happen. But they used to say big. And I said, what's big? What does that mean, big? And bigger than anything you've ever seen or we've ever seen. Well, that's big. It's a world war. It's World War III. So I feel bad for any soldiers there. And, you know, any undercover lovers, dig rabbit dig. Doesn't matter where you're at in the Middle East, this is going to be nuts. It will not go the way Israel thinks it will. It's going to be beyond ugly. I just hope all these nice, good soldiers we have enough sense to survive. And I'm sure they do, but I would not want to be there. I wouldn't want to be in a ship around there because you don't know if the Chinese are going to take a shot. You don't know what Russia sold them. We have, you know, the people running America, not the Americans, but the people running America, letting in all these new U.S. citizens and whatnot. They have a lot of enemies. You know, they have white America as their enemy. They made enemies with everyone, even their own people. I just don't know. I don't see happy endings here. But afterwards, it should be fascinating. Most of you are going to be very, very surprised. Godzilla's gone wild. She's went wild. Let's see what else. And these news reports I use, whether it be from Front Page or whatever, I have all kinds of news stuff that you wouldn't be able to get your hands on because you got to have subscriptions or something along those lines. I get stuff like that, but that's kind of pointless to use when basically it's the same old. So I try to use news reports that you can, you know, anyone can look up a report on Front Page Mag or anyone can Google the news reports I use on this show. The point is to get the average white rabbit out and thinking new thoughts, better thoughts, in a more healthier state of mind. And so I use news reports coming from name brand sources that anyone can read about. This is a Los Angeles Times. Let's see when this was done. This is just recently, March 14th. Chinese premier slams U.S. protectionism, says yuan is not too low. Well, the U.S. is blaming all the problems on the keeping the yuan too low. That's part of it. That's part of it. The challenge is that elements within the Anglosphere, especially America, have used China and continue to use China. And China has used this weak currency to build a manufacturing base. But, of course, you know, who sold them? Who allows this to happen? They didn't have to take this approach. This approach has been in place a long, long time. And so bitching at China now is not being really honest. You would have to take the problem apart and be really honest about it. You can't blame China for looking out for Chinese or wanting a manufacturing sector. What you can blame, Americans can blame people in charge that don't care about Americans and don't care about manufacturing. You know, blaming someone else for your problems doesn't work on me. China's supposed to look out for Chinese, and if they want a weak yuan, well, that's their business. There are many ways to go about fixing an enemy that fools with currencies other than bitching at them or bitching at them years after the fact. You know, Henry Kissinger went over there when? You know, when I was a little guy, a little boy, Henry Kissinger went over there when I was a little rabbit and started setting this stuff up. And now, so bitching at China for looking out for Chinese now is kind of disingenuous. And I think most real Americans understand that. They're looking out for China. We're upset because no one's looking out for America. At least the founders of America or actually anyone else. Because if you're in manufacturing, if you do anything to hurt white rabbits, you're going to kill the country. And believe it or not, black rabbits will be back in the situation they're in Africa. You know, they'd be in a Haiti type situation. Let's see what else. This is That, of course, is L.A. Times, and the Chinese premier is basically, you're going to see all kinds of rhetoric all around the world toward the U.S. These have seriously disrupted Sino-U.S. relations, Wen said. The responsibility does not lie with the Chinese side, but with the United States. Some countries' moves to shore up exports are understandable, he said, but what I cannot understand is they devalue their own currencies while on a contrary push for the appreciation of other currencies. I think it's protectionism. And that's what they've done. They've let the dollar go. The dollar during my lifetime has went to nothing. Comparatively, if you were to look at a year-on-year basis of the U.S. dollar against a basket of currencies, like a U.S. dollar index, you can look up the dollar index and look at it over the past, let's say since the Federal Reserve was created, go back 100 years, you're going to see a demon drop. So, you know, they've consistently devalued the dollar, but that they go on, now they want someone to blame. And, that's the way politicians work. Politicians don't fix systems. Systems fix politicians. That's the way things work. And that's reality. Let's see here. Al Aram, A-L-A-H-R-A-M. This is on, I believe, March 10th. This is an interesting piece. Possibilities of war. Iran. Despite how alarming the prospect of nuclear Iran might be to Washington, enhancing sanctions or authorizing preemptive strikes could lead to an all-out war the U.S. might lose, writes Azmi Bishara. And that's A-Z-M-I-B-I-S-H-A-R-A. And it's interesting, it talks about the reappointment of Robert Gates. It talks about what we already know, that in the distant past, the Arab national regimes of the 60s constituted the real threat. They were existentially antithetical to Israel and applied their energies against it on all fronts. Today, the visible danger resides in a hostile regime that is ideologically opposed to Israel and that has given no hint of an inclination to reach an understanding and that possesses advanced missilery. The Arabs, of course, remain the existential antithesis in the long run. But they are unorganized and they are not collectively represented by a sovereign state or even a several separate states. Benjamin Netanyahu has taken his thinking so far as to dub Iran the new Amalek. The references to the biblical Amaleks who occasioned the first divinely ordained genocide in history when the Old Testament Yahweh commanded the Israelites to destroy them totally, sparing no one, including women, children, and even their livestock. Of course, such a thing is not possible in our modern day and age. However, apparently it is possible for a secular prime minister of a democratic state to hurl an allusion to this blood-steeped legacy at his contemporary political enemies without raising the eyebrows of a civilized world, where the current bent of literature, arts, and dialogue conference of every sort is to heap scorn and derision on Ahmadinejad, and without stirring the New York Times into devoting even a small editorial to this dangerous and provocative indulgence in religious imagery. And I'll interject. The Jew rabbits are allowed to say whatever they want about Arabs or Ahmadinejad. They do it all the time. And then it talks about turning to the other half of Washington's dilemma. Its reluctance to start a full-fledged war against Iran resides in its anxieties over the fallout from such war and the rest of the reason. There's other anxieties, too. There's some other elements out there. And it goes on to say some interesting things, most of which we know. And it talks about U.S. treading water with care. If Tehran saw this as grounds for retaliatory skirmishes in the Straits of Hormuz, would the U.S. not respond to this challenge? In other words, might not the imposition of certain types of sanctions feasibly generate an all-out war? Of course. You know, that's what he's saying in this particular piece. And now we have, of course, on March 14th, it comes out in the Herald Scotland. This is the Sunday Herald of Scotland. This is Saturday, March 20th that I'm reading this, and this was done on March 14th. Let's see. Hundreds of powerful U.S. bunker buster bombs are being shipped from California to the British Isles, island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean in preparation for possible attack on Iran. Preparation for possible attack? No. Let's see here. Although Diego Garcia is part of the British Indian Ocean Territory, it is used by the U.S. as a military base under an agreement made in 1971. The agreement led to 2,000 native islanders being forcibly evicted to the Seychelles and Mauritius. The Sunday Herald reported that in 2007 that stealth bomber hangars on island were being equipped to take bunker buster bombs. quote-unquote, University of London, Dan Plesh, Director, Center for International Studies and Diplomacy. They are gearing up for total destruction of Iran. Although the story is not confirmed at the time, the new evidence suggests that it was accurate. Contract details for the shipment to Diego Garcia were posted on the International Tenders website by U.S. Navy. A shipping company based in Florida, Superior Maritime Services, will be paid roughly $699,500 to carry many thousands of military items from Concord, California, to Diego Garcia. Crucially, the cargo includes 195 smart guided blue BLU-110 bombs and 192 massive 2,000-pound BLU-117 bombs. I think those are those big daisy cutters or specialized, which would have been designed for this particular occasion. That's me interjecting. They are gearing up for total destruction of Iran, says Dan Plesh, Director of International Studies and Diplomacy at the University of London, co-author of a recent study on U.S. preparations for an attack on Iran. U.S. bombers are ready today to destroy 10,000 targets in Iran in a few hours. The preparations were being made by the U.S. military, but it would be up to President Obama to make the final decision. He may decide that it would be better for the U.S. to act instead of Israel. Plesh argued, the U.S. is not publicizing the scale of these preparations to deter Iran, tending to make the confrontation more likely. I'm going to repeat that again, what this guy quoted. The U.S. is not publicizing the scale of these preparations to deter Iran, tending to make the confrontation more likely. In other words, they're not advertising that they're shipping this stuff around. They're not advertising. These guys are digging into what they're shipping around and getting the actual records, and I guess they've been able to do that. But the U.S. is not advertising that to say, you know what, you better negotiate with us. They know there's no negotiation with Ahmadinejad. The U.S. is using its force as part of an overall strategy of shaping Iran's actions. They're trying to get them to do something. According to Ian Davis, director of the new independent think tank NATO Watch, the shipment to Diego Garcia is a major concern. We would urge the U.S. to clarify its intentions for these weapons and the Foreign Policy Office to clarify its attitude to the use of Diego Garcia for an attack on Iran, he said. For Alan McKinnon, chair of Scottish C&D, the revelation was extremely worrying. He said it is clear that the U.S. government continues to beat the drums of war over Iran, most recently in the statements of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. It is depressingly similar to the rhetoric we heard prior to war in Iraq in 2003. Yeah, it is. The British Ministry of Defense has said in the past the U.S. government would need permission to use Diego Garcia for offensive action. It has already been used for strikes against Iran during 91 and 2003. About 50 British military staff are stationed on the island with more than 3,200 U.S. personnel. Part of the cargo's archipelago, it lies 1,000 Chagos Archipelago. It lies 1,000 miles from the southern coast of India and Sri Lanka, well placed for missions to Iran. The U.S. Department of Defense did not respond to a request for a comment. What's happening is they're gearing up for war, and elements in Anglosphere are getting worried and upset. Rightly so. Rightly so. Now, will they get British permission? They probably already have on some level, if they even care. I mean, what are they going to do? And we have Iran arresting 30 for involvement in U.S.-led cyber war. That's ITP.net. ITP.net, March 14th, this particular piece. Iran is arresting people within Iran, 30 people from anti-Iranian groups, some famous ones. MKO were found to operate important organized networks for U.S. cyber war. Well, they've all been arrested. And we have the machinations are just getting bigger and more obvious. They're shipping stuff around. And they're probably trying to get things ready because Israel has said they're going to go, and if we go, you're going to have to go. There's really nothing you can do if Israeli trips the whole thing, and you know that's been a critical piece of the pie. Israel probably threatening to do all kinds of stuff, and that's come out in the Arab press. Al Jazeera, cross-cultural understanding. This was opinion editorials, March 2010. This was came out March 15th or March 16th. His name is Sam Hamad. Sam Hamod. How Israel could start World War III, and it's pretty obvious. He says Israel could start World War III by attacking Iran. It's that simple. Even Admiral Mullen, our head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, according to insiders who traveled with him to Israel in February when he was rebuffed by Netanyahu, Barak, and Lieberman. He worries about how we could be mousetrapped into a world war. Here's a scenario. Israel attacks Iran. Iran responds by attacking the American fleet in the Persian Gulf and by blocking the Straits of Hormuz, thus destroying our naval fleet and cutting off the world's oil supply from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other Middle East suppliers. America must respond by helping Israel and by holding up its status in the world. Thus, America attacks Iran. The Chinese and Russians have to respond by helping Iran, with whom they have major oil deals, and they cannot allow Israel American to gain a foothold. Thus, they enter the war. And they talk about all the different things, which are kind of obvious. It's kind of obvious they could do that, and that may be part of the plan by elements within the U.S. to let Israel trip it that away. That away, no one can blame the U.S. for defending its interests. They may do that, but you have to be ready in case they do that, you know. Kind of like, let Israel trip it, but then go in immediately afterwards so it doesn't to contain things. And I have no idea how crazy that could be. We can only imagine. The big news, of course, has been the criticism of Israel coming out of the White House. Yeah, Obama didn't give the first speech in the Middle East to Israel. He gave it in Egypt. Remember that? Yeah, Obama didn't give that speech in Israel. And of course, Israel, you know, Joseph Biden went over there and let's see the big news report. The big news report was that Israel's president smashed Biden's gift while ranting at the U.S. Yeah, he smashed something. Biden gave him a gift. The gift was like a pitcher. Let's see here. Let me read about this. He broke some glass. Now Clinton is secretly telling BB to stop it or else something secret will happen. The entire planet watches with the big smirk or rising horror, depending on whether they want the U.S. to die or survive. It's pretty interesting. They also went into this cave, this eternal flame they got lit, and the lights went out, creating total darkness. And the rabbis are saying it's an omen that it's going to be it's an omen that back to one of the biblical plagues of total darkness or something like that. You know, they're all superstitious. But Bibi Netanyahu, Biden gave him a pitcher of some type. I can't really, in the particular piece, this stuff has not come out widely in the U.S. press. And he gave him a pitcher of some type, a large pitcher, and the pitcher had a frame and it had some glass on it, and he pounded on it and broke the glass. And BB did. He did break the glass. In the New York Times, they were saying it was accidental, but I don't know that. You know, Jews breaking glass, I don't know if that's supposed to mean something or what. But White House ups the ante with new criticism of Israel. Hillary has told them to knock it off. And they could put the screws to Israel, but this might be the total part of the deal. They may have told Israel, you're going to have to go it alone. You're going to have to, create an angry moment. And then once you create an angry moment, you're going to have to go it alone with Iran. And then we'll step in to help and then we'll just blame you. Sounds kind of crazy, but they're that juvenile and they're that nuts. But that could work, you know, that way you can just blame the Jews, which, you know, there's going to be a lot to blame to go around, but Israel might be saying, you know, we're going to go or you're going to have to go, so you might as well just deal with that, because once we go, you're there already, you know, we got to go to protect our interests, and they can't stop, they have to go to war, they have to. And so maybe they just worked out a deal and they said, you know, you got to start mouthing off. We're going to have to put division between us. And there is already. They don't like Obama. They don't like Obama at all because Obama has a history of the Muslim world that goes a lot deeper than most think. Not necessarily saying he's a Muslim. I don't buy into all that. But, you know, when you get into Muslim Brotherhood and all kinds of interesting things about the Taliban, the fact that he gave a speech in Egypt and not Israel, that those things just irk the Jews. He's no John McCain. I've said this before. You know, they're all around Obama, but, you know, they're worried about this war. So they might have worked out some deal. You know, we're going to split off and we're going to have a lot of rhetoric. And into this rhetoric, you're going to go to war and we'll have to step in to protect our interests, but we're going to blame you. There's something like that. That would work to the American public. I know it sounds evil and devious, and it is. But they're going to go to war no matter what. So, you know, who knows? And right afterwards, it's going to be some big surprises. And his war is going to be big. You know, it's going to be huge. It's going to be a rolling start. And I'm guessing with the missiles going off already in Gaza and whatnot, it's already started. It's already been started. But it'll be a rolling start over 48-hour period. And during that period, a lot more people are going to get involved. And it's going to end up being a world war, supposedly. So keep your eye on it. Hillary went to Russia. Iran dispute becomes focus of Clinton's Russia trip. And Russia is now saying they're going to complete the nuclear reactors by July. And there's another reason they might be going to war soon. Besides everything on this planet falling apart, you know, Putin says he's going to build more nuclear reactors. We have Financial Times. Putin vexes U.S. over Iran nuclear power. March 18th. Mrs. Clinton said that Iran reassures the world of its behavior has changed because of international sanctions. They can pursue peaceful civil nuclear power. And this is a Financial Times piece, FT.com. And the title is Putin Vexes U.S. Over Iran Nuclear Deal. Basically, they said Vladimir Putin, Russia's prime minister, promised on Thursday, and this was last Thursday, this would have been I don't know, March 17th or whatever it was, or maybe Wednesday, promised on Thursday that Moscow would help Iran complete a civil nuclear power station by this summer, drawing criticism from Hillary Clinton, U.S. Secretary of State. I think they're talking about Thursday or Russia's time. And, of course, they're going to complete that civilian power plant, and that has drawn a lot of anger, to say the least, with her going over there. His remarks highlight the continuing differences between the two powers over how to contain Iran's nuclear ambitions. Mrs. Clinton was visiting Moscow on a trip partly designed to increase the pressure on Iran by showing America's unity with Russia. It doesn't work that way. Asked about Putin's remarks, Mrs. Clinton said it would be premature to go forward with any project in this time because we want to send an unequivocal message to Iranians. Well, what Putin wants is he wants to shape their action and when they're going to act. So by forcing the situation, he forces his opponent to move. He's always going to force you to move, and we're going to go back into Russia and German soft power. As you see this shaping up, we've seen huge movements across the planet. But that's what he's doing. He's shaping his enemy. He's constantly making his enemy move. He's constantly doing that for his team. He's a front man. He's the head of a spear. That's what Russia is, Mother Bear. She's the head of a spear. She's always moving, always making you move, always trying to shape your movements. And they will run you into the ground. So by saying that we're going to complete this nuclear power plant then, basically what he's telling certain parties in Anglosphere, what you see is what you get elements in Anglosphere, not the wise guy elements that he may be friendly with. But what he's saying is, you're going to have to move, and you're going to have to move now, or I'm going to do this. He doesn't have to do a whole lot. He doesn't have to do a whole lot, but once you do that, they have to respond. If they cannot respond, then they start losing more power. When you go into somewhere like London and you poison someone to death, you remember he poisoned that Russia, or they was accused of poisoning that Russia. If they can't respond, you lose power. If you respond in Georgia and I whip your tail, well, you lose power. And that's what he's doing. He's just basically grinding them down, making them respond, making them play his game. Whatever script he's on, and he is part of a team. And in the next little piece, I'm going to take a small break. I'm going to go into Europe. I'm going to go into politics within Europe. I'm going to talk about German soft power, the development of German soft power that has become very visible, especially post 1998, but definitely when the Berlin Wall came down. I'm gonna go into some things that I think maybe you need to know about. And German soft power can be within elements within America. It can be elements in South America. All the Americas are generally wide sky German soft power. What you don't see can kill you politically. German soft power. In Europe, it's become pretty visual nowadays. Germany can turn everything upside down. It is very visible when you have a Russian, German, Italian access. The Pope is talking about it, and you have Russia out there doing pretty much the Kremlin is working with the Germans night and day, and you have Putin out there on offense night and day. And we're going to go over this. I'm going to talk about how it relates to the German strategy, and it's actually the strategy employed by Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar, the talking points you're on. It's a similar strategy. I'm going to talk about it from another direction, driving an enemy. But he's constantly making the move, constantly making them adjust, and he's basically doing his job. Like you, you're doing your job. And I'll be back, and we're going to go into Russia and all everything that's just come out in the last few weeks on Russia and Germany. I'll be back in a second after I take a break. There's been big movements across Europe. You have Sarkozy in France. His poll ratings are plummeting, and Front National is winning. Has won some kind of poll. They're winning in the polls and they're winning elections. They're starting to do good again. You have Dominique de Villepin. De Villepin was very vocal at the United Nations opposing our war in Iraq, saying it was going to be disastrous for us. He was right. And of course, he is a pretty controversial individual. He would most likely be disliked by real Americans, but he wouldn't really pose a threat to us. I was always interested in how much he was an undercover lover for somebody like German soft power. Because there's all kinds of different connections between him and the Germans, but there always is between France and Germany behind the scenes, especially post-World War II. But Dominique de Villepin has been very, very critical of Sarkozy. Sarkozy tried to have him thrown in jail for that criticism. You can look up de Villepin. I don't really know how to spell his name offhand, but it's Dominique de Villepin. You might remember him at the UN, railing against the Americans. He is out of power, but he's looking to come back in power. And there's talk that, you know, Front National and some of the conservative elements like de Villepin might do some deal. There's all kinds of talks, all kinds of machinations. We have different talks going on between the UK and France, defense alliance driven by new strategic realities. And that's Deutschwell, dw-world.de. The EU's largest military powers are mulling over a joint defense alliance, which could change the face of European security. External factors may yet turn friendly rivals Britain and France into codependent allies. That's kind of an interesting piece. But that's a little bit too little too late to save Sarkozy. We have big moves, of course, in Austria. Telegraph, UK. Let's see, closet Nazi and running for Austrian presidency. And you gotta watch this woman, Barbara Rosenkranz. She's hardcore, Freedom Party, FPO. And she's an interesting character. She's an interesting character, and they're railing against her, saying I'll tell you in what the quotes are coming out of her. In 2003, the European Code of Human Rights already allowed a journalist description of her as a closet Nazi, noting their attitude toward Nazism was ambiguous. That's true. Such comments from a woman running for the country's highest office prompted scorching criticism from politicians of all colors, civil groups, and the Catholic Church. Rosenkranz's own supporters did what they could to limit the damage. Somebody like this is not eligible for election, said Vienna's Archbishop Cardinal Christopher Schönborn. While the Jewish community described her as an embarrassment for Austria, Rosenkranz challenges a Republican's anti-fascist foundation. That is unacceptable. Now things are changing. Rosenkranz is, she's pretty much mainstream right this minute. And she's in pole position, so watch her. That's Barbara Rosenkranz, Rosenkranz. She seems pretty harmless. She talks against, you know, no one knows what anyone's about this day and time, really. You don't. And what I'm going to do is talk a minute about Germany's strategy. If you read any of the recommended reading on what really has happened post-World War II, books like... especially books like Nazi International, lay out Germany's financial position coming out of World War II. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about historic German strategy, because it can be summed up by one word, and that word is Blitzkrieg. Most of us think we know the origins, but most Americans really don't. And so for my English-speaking audience, I'm going to go back over the origins of this type of strategy. By the way, when you employ the mantra, you're employing... Old Bob Whitaker's, he's Anglo-Saxon. I call him just a Saxon these days because I call the Anglos Angmos. You know, if you're a WASP, an old school WASP in America, I divide them up as Angmos and Saxons. Yeah, they, you got a lot of self-hating white animals over in America, and you got this WASP element on the East Coast that someone like old Bob can't stand. So instead of calling them all WASP or all Anglo-Saxons, I call the ones like Bob, Saxons, and I call the others Angmos, and I got that from the Asians. The Asians call all white people Angmos. Instead of Anglos, they can't say Anglo, so they say Angmo. And I thought it was kind of funny. So I divided up the self-hating white people in America. And if you're a self-hating white animal, I call you an Angmo. If you're like a WASP, like old Bob, I call them Saxons. But that's another story. That's a brief tangent for you guys. So anyways, Bob is a legitimate Saxon. And if you read any of his writings, he cuts right to the point. But the strategy is basically, you've heard of, everyone's heard of it, it is blitzkrieg, or firepower attrition. And this strategy, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you the basics of the strategy. Germany is always employed. They do it like clockwork. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you a standard geopolitical intelligence report, the standard stuff that they put out. This one anyone can get a hold of. This is a typical Strat 4 type thing. I always do Strat 4 because they're all the same. And you don't necessarily have to pay to get the one particular one I'm going to read about Germany's rise to power. And then I'm going to go over and talk about the head of the spear that's jostling across the planet, and that's Russia. Russia is the head of the spear of the German soft power, in my opinion. I think it's pretty obvious to anyone in the know. If there's a Russian, German, Italian axis, and the Germany's just sitting there, no one sees Germany do anything, and Russia's out there wailing on people, well, they're the head of the spear. There are elements in America, too, that are basically still European, still part of what I would consider German soft power. Elements in South America that are huge, where German soft power can be huge. Soft power is just that. It's, one phone call, one wink, one nod, and things start happening. You know, that type of thing. But let's go over Blitzkrieg. Blitzkrieg is rooted in basic German geopolitics. Historically, most of us think that the Blitzkrieg came from the Kaiser or Hitler. Did not. It came from Frederick the Great. Germany has always been, this strategy is not a byproduct of, again, fanatical Nazis or anything else, but Blitzkrieg is simply a geopolitical necessity. Germany has always been surrounded by powerful and potential enemies. Any given day, France could be an enemy, Russia could be an enemy, England could be an enemy, and at one time even Austria could be an enemy. So Prussia, under Frederick the Great, they basically had to develop a military that German for German, man for man, gun for gun, sword for sword could outfight and outmaneuver pretty much any enemy. Any enemy it had to, and it could always have to face enemies. And even historically, if you go back to the ancient German tribes, they were fighting every single day. And but that was perfected under Frederick the Great. And Blitzkrieg, or we'll call it in English, it's firepower attrition, became Prussia and later Germany's basically de facto military doctrine. The ability to concentrate overwhelming force at a locality, deliver a knockout punch, and then move rapidly to exploit the blow, or to turn and face a new enemy, would be the standard textbook, military textbook. And it was Frederick the Great, not the Kaiser, or Hitler, who created the doctrine. The Kaiser would later give it mobile and heavy artillery, and Hitler, of course, added the infamous Panzer Division, added the tanks and the dive bombers. But that is German strategy. And even the research in World War II into exotic weapons, into ancient texts, all revolved around Blitzkrieg. They able to deliver the knockout blow and move in to exploit. U.S. military also can operate under this type of tactic. Always provide as much ammunition as you can, overwhelming force at one locality, deliver the big blow, and then move in rapidly to exploit the blow. If you go to the top of the website, the talking points that Bugs developed, believe it or not, everything operates off that same, the same type of mindset. You have your acoustic weapons and you tone in those acoustic weapons using sound and you deliver a knockout blow, then you move in to exploit the chaos. and German soft power does it exactly like that. Russia, when they're using Russia, what Russia's been doing, they do it non-stop. And what I'm going to do is read a standard off-the-shelf piece that anyone can get a hold of. It's called Germany, Middle Europa, Mittel Europa Redux by Peter Zeihan. The global system is undergoing profound change. Three powers, Germany, Iran, and China, face challenges, forcing them to refashion the way they interact with regions and the world. We will exploit each of these three states in detail and in our next three geopolitical weeklies, highlighting how Stratfor's assessment of these states are evolving. We will examine Germany first. And, of course, I'll interject. Stratfor is not really examining them fully because they're just looking at Germany from a what you see is what you get. They don't believe race is real. They don't understand that. Typical stuff. And they do not understand that there's a, or they're not at least writing about it, which is more like it. They're not writing about Russia and Germany getting together and German soft power working with Russia. But let's go on and read this. European history has been the chronicle of other European powers struggling to constrain Germany, particularly since German unification in 1871. The problem has always been geopolitical. Germany lies in the northern plain, and France to its west and Russia to its east. If both were attacked at the same time, Germany would collapse. German strategy in 1871, 1914, and 1939 called for preemptive strikes on France to prevent a two-front war. The last two attempts failed disastrously, of course. And this is what I went into previously, so you'd help understand everyone's thinking on this. And that's me interjecting. As much as German strategy engendered mistrust in Germany's neighbors, they certainly understood Germany's needs. And so the European strategy after World War II involved reshaping the regional dynamics so that Germany would never face this problem again, and so it would never need to be a military power again. Germany's military policy was subordinated to NATO and its economic policy in European Economic Community, the forerunner of today's European Union. NATO solved Germany's short-run problem while the European Union was seen as solving its long-run problem. For the Europeans, including the Germans, these structures represented the best of both worlds. They harnessed German capital and economic dynamicism. Submerged Germany into a larger economic entity, gave the Germans what they needed economically so they didn't have to seek it militarily, and ensured that Germans had no reason or ability to strike out on their own. Now let me interject there. If you read the overwhelming evidence coming out on what the Germans actually had in World War II and shortly thereafter, you realize that Germany is a lot bigger military power than most of us realize. They're just not employing what you see as what you get weapons. You want to start, they can't have nuclear weapons. So how could a non-nuclear state have that much power? Is it all money? Or are they stacked with scalar weapons? Well, according to sources, according to yours truly's official sources, and according to the documentation he has, they've had next generation weapons. They didn't go nuclear, they didn't have to. They're part of something called the Scalar Club. And there are, you know, when you start talking about German fraternal organizations, they're all over Western civilization. They're all over the U.S. military. They're all over the place, period. So when you say Germany doesn't have a military, Germany has, post-unification, put together piece by piece their military into something top-notch. In a blink of an eye, it could be top-notch. They're not sending them all over the world, although I think Joseph E. Farrell talked about several different instances in his books where Germany has dispatched special military units all over the world and done so very, very quickly underneath the gun and very discreetly, like special forces. So there's some interesting stuff that's went on. It's definitely behind the scenes. If you talk to the Germans, they're not a military power. But if you lay out all the stuff and if you lay out all the numbers, something doesn't make sense on how they could wield so much power but not have any nuclear weapons. Everyone on Earth that wields that type of power has nuclear weapons. So what do they got? What are they doing? But let's go on and read this. This system worked particularly well after the Cold War ended. Defense threats and their associated costs were reduced. There were lingering sovereignty issues, of course, but these were not critical during the good times. Such problems can easily be dealt with or deferred while the money flows. The example of European development that represented the money over sovereignty paradigm was the European Monetary Union, best represented by the European Common Currency, the Euro. Stratfor has always doubted the Euro would last. Having the same currency and monetary policy for rich, technocratic, capital-intensive economies like Germany, and as for poor, agrarian, manufacturing economies like Spain, always seemed like asking for problems. Countries like Germany tend to favor high interest rates to attract investment capital. They don't mind a strong currency since what they produce is so high up on the value-added scale they can compete regardless. Countries like Spain, however, need a cheap currency since there isn't anything particular value added about most of their exports. These states must find a way to be price competitive. Their ability to grow largely depends upon getting access to cheap credit they can direct places to the market might not appreciate. Stratfor figured that creating single currency would trigger high inflation in the poorer states as they gained access to capital they couldn't qualify on their own merits. We figured such access would generate massive debts in those states, and we figured such debts would contribute to discontent across the Eurozone currency zones as the ECB, European Central Bank, catered to the needs of some economies at the expense of others. All this and more has happened. So they're patting themselves on the back. They were right on that. We saw the 2008-2009 financial crisis in Central Europe as particularly instructive. Despite their shared EU membership, the Western European members were quite reluctant to bail out the Eastern partners. We became even more convinced that such inconsistencies would eventually doom the currency union and that the Euro's eventual dissolution would take the European Union with it. Now, we're not so sure. What if, instead of the Euro being designed to further contain the Germans crafted the Euro to rewire the EU for their own purposes? See, the Germans will walk around time and time again, and they will say, we don't care about your politics, we are just here to help everybody. And then next thing you know, they're saying, we don't care about your politics, we have our own agenda. After the war in South America, they were actually saying that. They said, we don't care about your politics. We are just here, and we will tap some money with us, and we will take over and form some different partnerships, tech partnerships, and we don't care about your politics. Just let us play with our new technology. You know, and then it ends up being, we don't care about our politics, your politics. We have our own agenda. And that's what's going on right now in the EU. Germany in the current crisis. The crux of the current crisis in Europe is that most EU states, but in particular the Club Med states of Greece, Portugal, Spain, and Italy, have done such a poor job of keeping their budgets under control that they are flirting with debt defaults. All have grown fat and lazy off the cheap credit the Euro brought them. Instead of using that credit to trigger broad, sustainable economic growth, they lived off the difference between the credit they received due to the Euro and the credit they qualified on their own merits. Social programs funded by debt exploded. After all, the cost of debt was low as Club Med countries coasted on the bond prices of Germany. At present, interest rates set by the ECB stand at 1% in the past on its own merits. Greece often rose to double digits. The resulting government debt load in Greece, which now extends annual Greek gross domestic product, will probably result in either default triggered in efforts to maintain such programs or social revolution triggered by an effort to cut such programs. It is entirely possible that both will happen. What made us look at this new light was an interview German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble on March 13th, in which he essentially said that if Greece or any other Eurozone member could not write their finances, they should be rejected from the Eurozone. This really got our attention. It is not so much that there is no legal way to do this, and there is not. Greece is a full EU member, and the Eurozone membership issues are clearly a category where any member can veto any major decision. Instead, what jumped out at us is that someone of Schäuble's gravitas doesn't go about casually making threats, and this is not the sort of statement made by a country that is constrained, harnessed, submerged, or placated. It is not even the sort of statement made by just any EU member, but rather by a decisive member. Germany now appears prepared not just to contemplate, but to publicly contemplate the re-engineering of Europe for its own interest. It may not do it, or it may not do it now, but it has now been said, and then that will change Germany's relationship to Europe. A closer look at the Euro's effects indicate why Schäuble felt confident enough to take such a bold stance. Part of being within the same currency zone means being locked into the same market. One must compete with everyone else in the market for pretty much everything. This allows Slovaks to qualify for mortgage loans at the same interest rates that the Dutch enjoy. But it also means that efficient Irish workers are actively competing with inefficient Spanish workers, or more to the issue of the day, the ultra-efficient German workers are competing directly with ultra-inefficient Greek workers. The chart below measures the relative cost, and they go on to measure different costs. Let's see here. It all too vividly highlights what happens when workers compete. Those who are not as productive try to paper over the problem with credit. Since the euro was introduced, all of Germany's euro partners have found themselves becoming less and less efficient relative to Germany. Germans are at the bottom of the graph, indicating that their labor costs have barely budged. Club Med dominates the top rankings, as access to cheaper credit has made them even less efficient than they already were. Back of the envelope math indicates in the past decade, Germany has gained roughly 25% cost advantage over Club Med. They're talking about these southern countries, where Germany, Austria, the United States are kind of, the labor costs are a little bit above each other. Ireland's a little above Netherlands. You know, you get the message. Greece and all those countries were coasting. The implications of this are difficult to overstate. If the euro is essentially gutting the European, and again, to a greater extent, Club Med economic base, then Germany is achieving by stealth what it failed to achieve in the past 1,000 years of inter-European struggles. In essence, European states are borrowing money, mostly from Germany, in order to purchase imported goods, mostly from Germany, because of their own workers cannot compete on price, mostly because of Germany. This is not limited to states actually within the Eurozone, but also includes any state affiliated with the zone. The relative cost for most of the Central European states that have not just joined the Euro, that have not even joined the Euro yet, have risen by even more during the same period. It is not so much that Stratfor now sees the euro as a workable in the long run. We still don't. It's more of our assessment of the euro is shifting from the belief that it was a straitjacket for Germany to the belief that it is Germany's springboard. In the first assessment, the euro would have broken as Germany was denied the right to chart its own destiny. Now it might well break because Germany is becoming a bit too successful at charting its own destiny. And it dawns on one European country after another that there is more to the euro than cheap credit. The ties that bind are almost certainly going to weaken. The paradigm that created the European Union, that Germany would be harnessed and contained, is shifting. Germany now has found not only its voice, it is beginning to express and to hold its own national interests. A political consensus has emerged in Germany against bailing out Greece. Moreover, a political consensus has emerged in Germany that rules of the Eurozone are Germany's to refashion. As the European Union's anchor member, Germany has a very good point, but this was not the Union, quote, the rest of Europe signed up for. It is Mittel Europa, and the rest of Europe will remember it well. What Germany's doing, they're starting to what you see is what you get flex. As Russia has came out post-1998, and it's got more and more aggressively, especially post-2008 when Russia put the kibosh in the New World Order. I mean, they basically put the nails in the coffin. You don't have it, and they challenged them in Georgia, and the neocons and the whole entire Anglo elite fell to pieces after that. You know, they're flying back and forth to Russia trying to cut this deal. That is the head of Germany's soft power, Germany's spear, and Russia's not soft power. Russia's all over the place. And I'm going to go into detail about Russia. But what Germany did right after World War II, if you read books like Nazi International, which I would highly suggest, it's not about what you think it's about. It's about German financial dealings mostly. It's about different elements in Germany and how they set things up. It goes into the IG Farben breakup, and it was IG Farben was officially liquidated in 1952. However, it was not the liquidation on IG Farben, although it started in 1952. It was not wound up. It was not finished until November 10th, 2003. That should ring some bells. I mean, they got a lot going on. Every time you turn around, if you're buying a phone from, maybe you sell your business from T-Mobile. Well, that's Deutsche Telekom. These companies that you think, Germany just went away. They didn't go away. They just went kind of wide sky. They're all over the place. They're huge. And what's happening now is they're starting to flex. They're starting to put things in people's place to tell them this is how it's going to be. And it's kind of becoming obvious. I mean, even someone like Stratfor, and Stratfor, this is, you know, is something you can get by Peter Zeihan, and that's Zeihan, Germany, Mittel, Mittel, Europa Redux. And it's talking about Germans policy. But this particular blitzkrieg of concentrating your energy into one point, and then overwhelming force at one point, deliver a knockout punch, and then move rapidly, exploit the blow. That's what they've been doing into these crises. And it's a classic strategy. It's not that big of a deal. Russia's employing this in a very obvious manner across the board. They will concentrate their enemy energy at a few points, then move every time they get a point, they will move rapidly to cover and to get it again and to expand, and they will go in five different directions, but all in regards to geopolitics regarding their famous near and abroad. And I'm going to go over that next. But when it comes to what Germany's done post-World War II, it is just now becoming visible to the average person that this stuff that they set up was not set up to harness Germany. It only gave the illusion of hampering Germany. In the end, it will have actually served its purposes to reformulate itself post-World War II into something bigger and stronger as events unfold rapidly, as events have unfolded rapidly in succession post-reunification. Now, of course, that doesn't help the average German on the street. Why are they doing all this? Why are they going through all this nonsense, harassing us and bowing to the Jews and everything? You'll figure that out one morning. One morning you'll figure that out. It's part of a strategy. And, you know, I think the strategy is you know, it can be irritating, but there is an actual strategy being employed post-World War II. That's all I can tell you. If you read books like, I can't emphasize enough. You want to find out what they did financially, forget the title of the book, Nazi International. And read what's coming out from, all the basic different channels, and read between the lines. They're getting ready to make big moves across the board. And German soft power moves all across Western civilization. You know, the front of the spear is old Pooty Poot. They're in the Vatican. You got the Popey Pope, and the Pope has come under horrendous attack now. They should have done these type of attacks prior to him becoming Pope, but that's what happens when you start panicking. In America, they shut down an American Renaissance, a typical white nationalist-like conference. They throw one every 2 years. That's AMRNE, AMRNE.com. They shut it down, or they made a move, anti-racist and whatnot. It's filtered down. The panic is setting in. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to back over recent, because Russia has been the most active part. You can't really see what the Germans are doing. You can read about it, but you can't really see. On the other hand, Russia is very obvious that they're doing something. And I'm going to go back over Russia's near and abroad strategy and how that meets with German soft power. Because they're near and abroad, everything is focused. You know, it looks like they're geniuses, and they're very bright. They're very bright. But if German soft power is helping you, you will look like a genius as well. German soft power, I've said this before, and the Kremlin, oh my goodness. Because German soft power includes corporations all over the Western and Southern Hemisphere, and they're all over the place. Yeah, that's corporations. I mean, most of us understand that the Jews use the Jew rabbits and the pink rabbit banksters and elitesters use corporate positions to do other things. Well, so does everyone. So does everyone. They just tend to get caught because they're upside down. But I'll be back, and I'm going to go back over Germany's strategy and how Russia has been deployed, and Pooty Poot Rabbit. He's out there always running and gunning. So let's have a little talk about Russia. And Russia's strategy is not ever defined by borders, because their borders are, I mean, it's the biggest country in the world. It's 2.5 Americas, or 2.25 Americas, or 2 Americas and a few Texases thrown in, or something like that. The place is huge. So its strategy is always called near and abroad. Basically is what I call it. Many others call it that too, but we saw their strategy come to fruition when they clashed in Georgia and started putting the nails in the coffin of the New World Order. That was a big problem. It was a challenge directly, militarily, that could not be answered. We've seen this in Azerbaijan. We've seen this in Armenia. They're putting this together. That's on their, toward their Iranian border. On the other side, of course, they do deals with China, and then China's always in it with them. China has tried that stuff to get, in the East and to start breeding, you know, start having a lot of babies there and to come over there and work and everything else. But, China knows the elements within China don't want problems with Russia simply because Russia's not going to man up and fight them soldier to soldier. Russia's going to hit them with next generation weapons, or Germany will hit them with next generation weapons. It'd be over with. But anyways, Russia's strategy is basically to make friends everywhere. But where strategy becomes really clashing with NATO, mostly elements in Anglosphere, would be in Ukraine, Belarus, and the famous Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And we saw this come to a head in Ukraine. After Georgia, the focus is on Ukraine. Ukraine now fell. And so the focus will be on the Big Four, the northern plains, as they call it. Belarus, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. Now Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia are NATO members. I don't think Belarus is. Belarus is pretty much in Russia's back pocket, but they play kind of both sides of the game, both sides of the coin. But when it comes to Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, they are NATO members. But in NATO, you have Germany. So you have jockeying from within NATO with vis-a-vis German soft power, and you have Russia making its move. And it will try to consolidate power and then confront these heretic states on as the German-Russian-Italian axis comes into formation. I am not interested in what Russia does. Well, I mean, I am, but it'll be interesting to see how Germany helps them, because Germany is helping them. Germany's helping them big time. They're a team. They're a team. They work together. And let's read some news headlines of what's come out. Basically, every time Pooty Poop makes a move, it's just shock and awe. And as soon as everyone gets over that, or before anyone can get over that, he makes a move again. Just this week, it came out to the Obama administration is planning on banning offshore drilling in 2012. Well, Russia moved in. This is according to the Washington Times. Obama surrenders Gulf oil to Moscow, and they're not talking about Saudi Arabian Gulf. They're talking about the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, Russia's over in the Gulf of Mexico, ready to drill oil. So any of you white rabbits, you may be working for a Russian oil company or something like that, which is all right. They're white too, and they'll hire you quicker before anyone else. But that's a funny story. But they can't really do anything with them anymore. Let's continue talking about Russia. And another thing that's happened is what has happened is as Anglo elites got bogged down. Russia makes its move, and then, of course, you know, everyone else in the world has to adjust, and while you're adjusting, they make another move. They're getting ready to drill for oil in Gulf of Mexico. They aren't sitting still anywhere in the world. And, of course, the big news was in the Wall Street Journal, the opinion piece for Asia. Putin steps into the India breach. The Obama's administration neglect of New Delhi is starting to have serious foreign policy consequences. And he's over there selling basically military equipment to India, which they always have, but he's increasing ties. So as we become bogged down in foreign policy, the big spear for German soft power, the Kremlin German soft power entangle is just on a tirade across the planet. No hold barred, just making moves, letting everyone adjust, and before anyone can adjust, they'll just make moves again. And they're doing this night and day, why we are bogged down in all these crazy wars. It's not good for certain elements of Anglosphere, but others find it hilarious, because it makes sure Europeans have a home, you got to understand that if Horace the Avenger doesn't have a home, if you don't have a home in Australia or you don't have a home in Russia, well, Mr. Putin doesn't have a home. It means his grandchildren aren't assured of a home. And so it puts everyone on the same page, which is good. It gets everyone working for the same goal in one way, shape, manner, or form. But the other big news, of course, is Hillary's over there for talks that didn't go that well. She probably already knew what was going on. She's extremely friendly with the Russians. But, you know, they have their little spat for public and whatever. And the CFR, this Council of Foreign Relations, this type of thing, all this stuff just burns them up. It just burns them up. They did a big piece. Let's see what they have online. In Moscow talks, Iran looms. You know, Secretary of State Hillary's agenda for her Moscow visit this week includes a second strategic arms limitation treaty. CFR Stephen Sestanovich, former ambassador at large and advisor on former Soviet republics in the Clinton administration. And it's basically just talking about Russia basically giving us problems. That's it. End of discussion. It's an interesting piece. And really, he says nice things. He says there's a reset button with the Russia's relationship, and it's working a little slower than they want, but elements within the administration are very happy, and elements aren't, which is kind of interesting. You wouldn't think it would be... this piece actually sounds somewhat positive, but he's not... I don't believe he's a neocon. If you're not a neocon, then everything's going a little bit better for you. If you are a neocon or have your heart set on neocon... it really depends, but this piece also came out before Russia said they were going to go ahead and build that plant in July or finish the plant in July. And what the CFR says is basically whatever the Russians do, the Chinese might follow suit. And he says this is the big question of the diplomatic dance that's now underway. If the Chinese feel that it's watered down, they're talking about sanctions against Iran, and they don't like the idea of being lone holdout in the Security Council vetoing powers, they'll come along. On the other hand, if they're really unhappy with the idea of sanctions and want to block it, maybe they'll work out a position with the Russians that makes it impossible to reach any agreement so they don't look like they're the only obstacle. China continues to work with Russia in partnership with this type of thing, which is interesting. Which tells you what elements in China are in control, because again, when in doubt, look at German soft power. And when Russia moves, that's moving with them. You know, German companies will be taking advantage of things and so on and so forth. Let's see here. And you can tell the difference even in the Council of Foreign Relationships. There was an op-ed piece just last September, and this is a famous one. The road to Tehran does not run through Moscow. And this is Jeffrey Mankoff, adjunct fellow for Russian studies. He's a neocon. Oh, are they upset? Russia vetoed their new world order. Oh, do they just hiss and moan and piss and moan and piss and moan? And this has come out just recently. Has become, overwhelming. Khodorkovsky is on trial again for his life, basically, for another 22 years. And his buddy, the ex-head of the Yukos subsidiary, I don't even know this guy's name. Let's look up this guy's name. Sergei Shimkenevich, the Tomsneft chief. He basically got another 12 years. This was as of Tuesday, March 16th, and this is kind of American time zone, so I guess it was the day before or the day after. I guess it would be the day after. But he was a former lawmaker out there and working with Khodorkovsky, and he got railroaded. Former Yukos CEO Mikhail Khodorkovsky is serving an 8-year prison term, also for fraud and embezzlement, and faces up to 22 more years. So his buddy that was on trial with him has already been hammered another 12 years. Khodorkovsky and all the neocon media is just whining and crying about Khodorkovsky. You'd think they whine and cry about some of the other political dissidents, but no, Khodorkovsky's their boy, probably because he's Jewish, and they think he's been poorly treated, but he would probably be the only long-shot hope if the Red Hippo could go free him out of jail and overturn Russia. And, of course, he's making big, big threats. He's threatening Russia faces bloody revolution, says jailed oligarch. anything at all can be the trigger for social explosion. What is strange is that Russia's ruling elite seems totally unafraid. Not even its instinct for self-preservation is working properly. And this is Kartikovsky speaking. You know, big fear tactics, big Jew boy fear tactics from behind bars. I guess he's part Jewish or 100% Jewish or something. But they think they still run Russia. You don't. You don't run Russia. That's why you're in jail out in Siberia next to a nuclear waste dump. When Mr. Kartikovsky was up for parole, a funny thing happened. They said he didn't attend all his sewing classes, and so that vetoed him. Yeah, that vetoed him. That was kind of funny. And this is according to even Wikipedia. Release date. According to his official site, Kartikovsky would have been eligible for early release, but an alleged conspiracy involving jailed guards and a cellmate resulted in a stalemate that Mikhail had violated one of his prison rules. The statement was false. Of course it was. But it was sufficient to make Kartikovsky lose his rights once the statement was logged in his file. It is predicted that he might be released in the middle of 2011, although Kartikovsky is currently awaiting trial on fresh charges of embezzlement and money laundering. It could lead to a new sentence of up to 27 years. I thought it was 22 years. I guess I was wrong. He alleged that both cases are instigated by Igor Sechin. I told you about him. Igor, S-E-C-H-I-N. He's someone you don't want to cross paths with, at least on the wrong side of the street. The second, as well as the first case, was organized by Igor Sechin. The tycoon claimed in an interview Sunday Times from a remand prison in Siberian city of Chita, 4,000 miles east of Moscow. On August 22, 2008, he was denied parole by Judge Igor Faliev at the Ingo-Dinsky Regional Court in Chita, Siberia. The basis for this was in part because Kartikovsky refused to attend jail sewing classes. Yeah, so all these guys worried about him getting out. If he gets out, Jesus will come the next morning, demand that all the Jews convert or get their heads cut off. That's what I expect. It could happen. It could be part of the plan. Get that big Jesus rabbit out there. Convert or die, the final solution with no air pollution. It'd solve Christianity. It would solve Judaism. It would end this age with a big bang. Can you imagine the look on the rabbis' faces if they had to bow to Jesus? Can you imagine that look? Wow. That would be something to see. But Mr. Kartikovsky and the neocons are promising bloodbath. I don't know. I guess if the red hippo goes and springs him, maybe he'll get lucky. But I look for him to get either another jail sentence or to something funny to be up. I don't know. But you got Pajamas Media. That's the neocon media. Putin versus Kartikovsky, the courtroom as a battlefield. And this is so funny. Putin panicked just as his puppet frontman Dmitry Medvedev cravingly backed out of a scheduled appearance at the closing ceremonies of Vancouver Olympics after Russia turned its worst performance on the field and off. Putin simply did not have the confidence to face a titan like Kartikovsky man-to-man. Now two armies are gathered fighting two simultaneous battles, one in Strasbourg and one in Moscow. The soldiers are lawyers, and the result of their combat will likely determine Russia's future as well as perhaps a good deal of our own. What they're saying is that the European Court of Human Rights is going to try. They filed a $100 billion lawsuit against Putin in the European Court of Human Rights. The problem with that is that comes in the German soft power and Russia's soft power, and Russia's been buying up Europe right, left, and center. And no one likes the Kartikovskys. Anti-Semitism is again on the rise, and that affects things. So Kim Ziegfeld is a New York City-based writer. And of course she's a Russian specialist, yes, La Russiaphobe. And of course they're hoping that they get something going. Kartikovsky rails against authorized violence against him in the judicial system. 3% of the population, this is our most active part, is at critical mass, necessary and efficient for radical changes. He's talking about revolution. He's calling for bloody revolution in jail. It's interesting. But what most neocons don't understand, because they're too hard-headed. You see, what happened to the Jew rabbits is they became arrogant, especially the Jew rabbit part of the neocons. Not all of them are Jewish, but the Jew rabbit part of the neocons, very arrogant. They used to run the media. And when you run the media and write something, you can affect things all over the world. People can be afraid of you. But they can no longer really do that. and they're no longer exercising broad power within Europe. The Germans indulged them. That was part of the strategy. I'm going to go into part of the strategy again because it's pretty funny. But they can write things all day long, but they're not affecting anything. This isn't the time when they run, you know, they may run Fox News to some extent, but they don't really run anything anymore. They're kind of just out in the front there, waiting to get slammed into the ground, you know, waiting for someone just to come over and just push them off their stool. But they are filing suits. Yuko seeks $98 billion from Russia in European human rights case. This was in Business Week. And this is a last-ditch effort. I'm surprised they didn't do this 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, this guy's been in jail a while. But they're very arrogant. And of course, you know, they're filing suits in European human rights courts. They're trying, like anything, to make moves. Elements are trying to make moves against the Pope. But once you get a Pope sitting in office saying that, you know, he was around when some pedophile did something, there probably isn't anyone in the Catholic Church right now, any cardinal, that you couldn't pin that on, tragically. Especially, you know, in America, if you had some famous cardinal, I'm sure they've all been around when some scandal broke of abuse in the church. Well, it's a big organization. A big organization with an old history is going to have an ugly history ready to come out. And there's a lot of ugly history when it comes to abuse in the Catholic Church. It's tragic but true. But that ain't going to fly, because why would he give up the Vatican just because they're crying about that? But I'm surprised they didn't do this years ago. What you're seeing is broad-based, you know, you're seeing low level, you're seeing panic. You're seeing panic happen at the low level, so they're doing everything possible. Now, have they been sold out? Yes. Yeah, you were sold out. You were sold out. They can't, they would have sold you out a long time ago, but you're such an albatross. Someone let you hang around their neck for a while, until it was time for them to sell you out. but the pink rabbit banksters and leaksters could care less about Jew rabbits. They could care less. Jew rabbit elites could care less. And that's the problem. That's the problem coming into this war. The Jewish elites in the diaspora are well hated, even among Jew rabbit elitesters in Israel, for obvious reasons. I mean, they sent them to war. They made them go to war with Lebanon. You know, Israel wasn't crazy about war with Lebanon. Only a couple people there were crazy for war with Lebanon. But you have all these neocon elements, these Jew rabbit elites in America that are so high in themselves, so arrogant. They sent them to war and they got hammered. So they're not crazy about these people, and that's forming that state was the worst mistake in the world for the Jew rabbits, especially for the pink rabbit banksters and elitesters. You just can't make a move like that. You can't make a move with the world watching you. You can't live under those double standards. But what's funny is, even within America, the neocons and their instant their crazy Russia fatalism has come under attack. The funny piece, I don't even know, it's called True Slant. It's a beta online, but there's some funny articles on it. It's called True Slant. Mark Edomanis. I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name, but it's Mark Edomanis on Russia. Who is the world's worst Russia analyst? Stephen Blank. is funny. The first contestant is Dr. Stephen Blank of the U.S. Army War College. Blank is a notorious Russia-phobe and pessimist and has a charming habit of always being wrong about everything. For example, in a 2008 article in Post-Soviet Affairs, Blank used the creation of a minor investigations committee, the Russian shorthand, which is SK, an utterly ineffectual and colorless reform that was literally no different than hundreds of other bureaucratic reshuffling before or since, to make the following hysterical observations. The SK can thus be used to purge enemies from their position to clear space for members of a victorious grouping, just as occurred in 1937, if not from the work of Ivan the Terrible's 16th century opricina. Thus, the SK will escape any accountability, even of a purely formal kind, to the Duma, which, while the sword of Damocles over every official's head, undoubtedly the SK has already become a major actor, or at least a potential major actor, on Russian politics in this succession. Here's an interesting question I have. How is it humanly possible to think that anything going on in Russia these days, good, bad, or in between, bears any relationship to the Great Terror? Well, where are these millions of bodies, the existential dread, the omnipresent hysteria, paranoia, and panic? In what possible sense can Putin be compared to Ivan the Terrible? Of course, the Russian figures to which he bears the most resemblance are Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, westward-looking autocratic modernizers, but even those comparisons are absurdly strained as to be worthless. As someone who fancies himself a professional historian, Blank should be ashamed he ever put this claptrap down on paper, let alone had it published in a peer-reviewed journal. It is hard to overstate how utterly, entirely wrong this analysis has proved to be. Has the Dred Investigations Committee done anything of note? Of course not. Why? Because as anyone could see, Putin is not seeking revolutionary upheavals and totalitarian bloodletting, but like any two-bit populist authoritarian, social peace and stability. Not stability 10 years down the road as could conceivably result from a massive and bloody internal purge, but stability yesterday, stability now, and stability tomorrow. Putin has, above all else, been scrupulously cautious and patient in his activity as a politician. What he goes on to say is these neocons are horrible in their analysis, and he's 100% right. And he's talking about, seriously, despite all the dark mumblings and panic ruminating about clan wars, and you've heard this, there's going to be huge clan wars within the Kremlins. Well, the neocons say things, assuming they could say it and make it true. They're delusional wild animals. What has come of it? A few minor members of the Kremlin inner circle have been shuffled into retirement, and Medvedev has promoted a few civiliki instead of, Civiliki to positions in the presidential administration. This is a moral and political equivalent of murdering the entirety of a general staff, wiping out 90% of the members of the central committee. He's basically making fun of all this crazy analysis. As another example of his profound myopia and inaccuracy, take Blank's quote about the trial of Mikhail Khodorkovsky. He basically writes that Khodorkovsky was a good guy, railroaded. On trial are more than human rights in Russia, pledged to uphold when it signed the Helsinki Treaty in 1975. Kremlin's aim to punish Khodorkovsky lest he become free to speak out politically. Well, what's happened, ladies and gentlemen, is a group is going down, and they're going down hard, and they're going down in flames, and their whole entire New World Order is a no-go. It is adios, amigos. And now it's crunch time. Now you got to go to war with Iran. Now you're in trouble. Now the noose tightens across the board. And what they're doing is, you know, all they can do is write these pieces. All they can do is squirm and moan and cry and wait for the inevitable. But you see it across the board in elements and among the Langle elite, especially the American elite, anything tied to the neocons. They're sulking. They're moaning. They're oh, hope is lost. And it is. Yeah. You'd think they sound like old school white nationalists saying all hope is lost, but these guys, let me tell you, all hope is lost for them. And, soon the world will figure that out. But anyways, he goes on to talk about all this, and it's a funny piece. It's really funny. Blank's work is comically one-sided, but that's typical of neocons. And, over the next, I'm guessing over the next bit, we're gonna see all the machinations conclude, coming into this war. We'll see more and more news pieces. We'll see more and more, you know, you got General Petraeus, warns U.S. looks increasingly weak. Oh no. Neocon peace, the Klaxon, want peace, prepare for war as Iran, Syria, ready nuclear programs. Oh my. Tehran aiding Al-Qaeda. Not, here's Petraeus again. Tehran aiding Al-Qaeda links. Uh-oh. The missing link, the smoking glove. They're aiding Al-Qaeda. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't catch Osama bin Laden and pull him out, put him in front of the world, and he'll say I was aided by Iran or something. Watch this. It's funny stuff. And, of course, you have white America getting angrier and angrier. So much so I was reading a piece by Jared Taylor. Jared Taylor over at Ameren, he's pretty staple. He's basically a paleoconservative. And he has a piece, Reap the Whirlwind. What are rulers' non-reaction to American Renaissance 2010 suppression really means? And he ends it. He ends it sounding like a steely-eyed lone wolfer. But when our rulers are indifferent to the suppression of legitimate debate on most pressing issues we face, they encourage rage and radicalism, the consequences of which no one can predict. Coming from Jared Taylor, that's a pretty surprising piece. He was really upset about them getting together, but that they're just upset because they're panicking. They're panicking. They realize now how bad this is going to be. They were looking for... you know, everyone's always looking for Germany to rebuild nuclear weapons or something like that, and they took a totally radical different approach. totally radical different approach. And every day, every hour, they get more power. And German power means the death of the other side's new world order. German, Russian, Italian access, and what's happened after Russia confronted them in Georgia and put them down. The fact that they got to go to war with Iran. War with Iran has always been the end game. They're over with once they do that. It's tragic that so many of our guys have to go with them. But, you know, the strategy was give them everything but their new world order. And the easiest way to see the strategy employed was the one that drives all the white nationals crazy. And what they do is they sit and you can observe this with the Jew rabbits all day long. What they do is they just put them at the top and build them up and make sure they get everything but their new world order. Because if they're at the top, they become totally blind. I mean, they become totally blind. And there's a great example of this. I'll give you one that the whole world can look at. This happened on, I don't know, what is this piece? This is a random piece I picked out to demonstrate this. Prince Philip, we were jealous of the Jews. Queen Elizabeth's husband admits family had inhibitions about Jews, sympathized with Nazis early on. And this is from Ynet, ynetnews.com. This is Israeli service. And he basically talks about, his attraction to the Nazis. And of course, when you say you were jealous of the Jews, what he's saying is some members of the European royalty elite were jealous of the Jews, did so well financially very quickly. But you know, when you're in a dark age, if you're a materialistic base, and the Jew rabbits are materialistic oriented, you're going to do quite well. But what he's really doing, he's appealing to their vanity, and he's appealing to he's appealing to the fact that they believe that. They believe that everyone's always jealous of them. They believe that, and they eat that up. If you admit that you're jealous of them, they just eat that up. But what they've done is they put a lot of these guys at the top, and they just become paralyzed when you appeal to their vanity, when you appeal to their arrogance and their hubris. It has been a devastating approach, because what's happened is the elites, the different elements of the Jew rabbits, have become paralyzed. Their elites are afraid. They're afraid of getting kicked out of another country. They're afraid of disaster. And as they get afraid, you know, the pink rabbit banksters and leasers are afraid of tribunals, and it all just filters down. And what's happened globally is elites have been separated from their from the people they serve. This is across the board in China and in Israel and everywhere else. And so they're panicked. They become afraid. But when you become afraid, that is a whole nother level of uncertainty. So this approach of keeping them fat and happy, letting them have everything but their new world order, the pink rabbit banksters have become pretty much assuming they had everything together up until Russia. When Russia, the German spear got out there dancing, it became really obvious that they had problems. Then you had the internet. When things start going wrong on this time in the calendar, it all goes wrong quickly. And, you know, you have the famous statement by Wesley Clark. You know, Russia is, they're a game changer for us. Or what did he say? I quoted him exactly on one of my early MP3s. That Russia basically killed the New World Order, their particular version. And that's they're doing their job, as we're going to do our job. But when you see royalty like that say these statements, it's partially true. You know, the Jew rabbit elites were better at stealing from the people than many elements of the European royalty, and they were jealous of that. But it's also appealing to their vanity. It's appealing to what works. It freezes them. And as it's come into post-2001, they become more and more frozen, especially at the elite level of fear, because they don't want to... the thought of getting kicked out of another country, the thought of those things, they're driven by fear, to say the least. The ones in Israel don't really care because they have Israel, but even then they're surrounded by enemies. They didn't really realize what type of trouble they were in. The pink rabbit banksters and elitesters in general have not realized what type of trouble they're in. And if they're in trouble, the Jew rabbits are in a whole lot of trouble. But you know, when you read pieces like that with when Queen Elizabeth husband makes statements like that, you know, that we were just jealous of their success, they eat that alive. I looked at the comments just now, and one of the comments going back to 2006 is from Chaya in Israel. Now, I'm not saying that every Jew is an Einstein. We have our idiots too, but for the most part, our accomplishments are something the non-Jewish world could feel threatened by. When looking at us, they can see their inadequacy. This is how they think, you know. They love reading that. Oh, they love reading that someone's jealous of them, or that someone that they're so brilliant. You know, Jew rabbits is so brilliant. Jew rabbits is God's chosen rabbit. Well, if you have an enemy and they're prone to arrogance, well, keep them arrogant. Keep them on top. Keep them blind. And then when it's time to move, move. And that's what they've done. And they're still divided. Their elites are divided. They are sitting and reeling, wondering what's coming, what they've agreed to, what the pink rabbit banksters and elitesters have been forced to agree to. And as it filters down the whole scenario and how wild this is going to be, it will be the show of the millennium. It will be the show of probably 100 millennials. And the last piece I'm going to talk about, we're going to do one more piece, and this will be the end of the war prepping for news. So keep your eye on Germany. Keep your eye on those Baltic states. Keep your eye on what the Germans do for the Russians. Keep your eye on, Germany doesn't do a whole lot, but now they're not only doing things or saying things. Everyone's always assumed that they would reassemble their weaponry like they did in the Third Reich or something. They didn't do it that way. Piece by piece, day by day, decade by decade. That great eagle just starts rising again. You know, the green goddess is just running around there putting things together. Just not at once, not all at once, just piece by piece. Putting things together. And I think that piece I read by Stratfor says it all. The behind the scenes pieces that are coming out by the different financial houses that get paid a lot of money, different analysts that get paid a lot of money to write stuff for, like, hedge funds who have a lot of money to pay them, you know, are saying they should have just called the Bundesbank should just rename itself, should have just called itself the Reichsbank. They should have never left that name alone. It's becoming apparent that they had a long-term strategy. If you read books like Nazi International that I mentioned long ago, it is apparent that they have a long-term strategy based on the government documents that he reveals. Financially speaking, all Mr. Farrell's books are mistitled, but they had a long-term global strategy, and that strategy has now become impossible to ignore. You know, when you have financial analysts to say, why did they just keep the Reichsbank? I mean, it's obvious what they're doing. They're cornering everything. They're getting ready to make big moves. I mean, but they've been done it piece by piece. They put it together over long periods of time. And, constantly moving on to the next thing and just putting it back together. They made big moves militarily, actually, putting together different elements of their military again. But they didn't do it all at once. They did it piece by piece. They have air forces. They have air force bases over here in America. I talked about that. I talked about the German Air Force in the U.S. There's been an Air Force group at Holloman Air Base in New Mexico, and it's near White Sands Testing Grounds. They're all over the place. They're all over the place. They don't say it, they just do it. But a lot of people talk about German military being nothing. German military and German soft power are a lot bigger than most people realize. It's the only non-nuclear power that can make moves across the board. It's the only non-nuclear power. Why would Russia want to do business with a non-nuclear power? It's pretty odd. It's pretty odd for a non-nuclear power to have that type of power post-World War II, but they do. Because there's another factor in this. This next generation technology and what they've been able to do. They don't need nukes. They don't need them anymore. But the last but not least is about all the sea serpents, the Orfish Omen, Telegraph, UK, Orfish Omen spells earthquake disaster for Japan. Japan is bracing itself after dozens of rare giant Orfish, traditionally the hairbringer of a powerful earthquake, have been washed ashore or caught in fishermen's nets. They're saying this was just in the beginning of March. They're catching massive numbers of Orfish, that are pretty rare. And, And it freaks out the Asians, because usually when this happens, it portends disaster. So that's something I thought I'd leave you with. Maybe we'll get some more earthquakes or something. I hope not, but you never know. But this is another end to Follow the White Rabbit, and this was an extensive news piece. One last thing before I leave you here. I thought of something else I'd put in here. Traditionally in Europe, the different countries can't agree on the color of sky. White rabbits are like that. They can't agree on anything. And typically our enemy, the front of our enemy's sword is always the Jew rabbits. The Jew rabbits are out in front for the pink rabbit banksters and elitesters nonstop. And they typically employ a divide and rule, just like they do against white nationalists or anyone else. Typically, this type of divide and rule strategy of Europeans not being able to disagree on the color of the sky has worked quite well from time to time. It has its flaws. And what the Germans and the Russians are showing is that they can play it bigger and better. This divide and rule tactic of Europeans not being able to agree on anything has served Germany's purposes very, very well post-World War II. It definitely has served its purposes and served Russia's purposes of late. Everyone sees them employing this. Russia is just obvious divide and rule. That's all they do. But this tactic can also be deployed by us within America. As different groups start wanting to work with us, we can also apply divide and rule. Different groups want different things. There's many different directions to go, but always think in terms of me a white rabbit, you a white rabbit. Don't make things difficult. Look to work off, you both dislike something. Forget about what you like. Think about what you dislike. But divide and rule works very, very well because you're very they're coming out of a demoralized state. Conservatives want this, liberals want this, and everything's becoming racial. You have all these different groups and cross currents and sub cross currents, and really look into what the Germans did. There's a lot of information out there. Certain books, certain careers are being made of, are in the process of being made of pointing this out. But they're employing a divide and rule. And most people think that Europeans can't get it together because they can't agree on anything. Well, that can be a weakness. It can also be a strength. If someone like the Germans, Russians, and the Pope and down there in Italy are looking to put something big together, they can do it very quickly because everyone else is divided and powerless against it. In somewhere like America, you could put something together very quickly simply because so many other people would be divided against it. Not necessarily for it or against it. You can employ some more strategies. Especially when you have so many different cross currents and so many different subgroups and so many different, everyone's got this environmental agenda. There's just so many different agendas. If your agenda is simple and you have any type of planning skill at all, Germany's agenda has been very simple. We don't care about your politics. We have our own agenda. And that is a good thing to have, because if you don't have your own agenda, you're going to be running someone else's. So that's our policy. We don't care about your politics. We have our own agenda. That's a good white rabbit policy. Always have your own agenda and do whatever's necessary to make it work. But divide and rule can really work with a lot of different cross currents and all this different noise. And that's all you have is a bunch of noise and everyone angry. And that's what we see. Everyone is very, very angry. And if a financial collapse comes about right before the war, it's going to be even more anger. So look to take advantage of that in a variety of different ways. You use your big white rabbit head. And this is 36. This is the final end of 36. And I'll be back with you on 37.
This is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Follow the White Rabbit, again, is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is practical because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is voting politics or rule-based politics. And the ultimate, of course, is full-spectrum practical politics, engaging and taking down an opponent, a system, by any means necessary, within the rules, within the law, but never breaking them. And this is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Thank you for listening.